by starting to work in neuroeconomics, I'm able to make use of my skills coming from psychology and neuroscience to characterize the most interesting aspect of human behavior, for me at least, and that is how humans make tough choices.
Hello and welcome to this episode of A Grey Matter. I'm Rebecca Archer. Why do we buy one car and not the other? What should I pay my staff? How much am I prepared to spend on a house? As a research fellow in neuroeconomics in Professor Jason Mattingly's lab, Dr. Dragan Rangelov investigates human sensory perception, decision-making and memory. He's also at the centre of efforts to establish a neuroeconomics research profile at UQ. Dr. Rangelov's work explores how the brain processes and stores information that leads us to make decisions in all aspects of life. He does this by using techniques designed to measure and record brain activity, such as electroencephalography, EEG, and functional magnetic resonance imaging, and by identifying patterns of neural activity associated with external sensory stimuli. Thank you so much for your time today, and welcome to the podcast, Dr. Rangelov.
Thanks, Rebecca. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're particularly interested in decision-making and attention. What are the brain systems responsible for decision-making?
Yes, you're correct. Most of my work relates to mechanisms that people use to make decisions or to selectively attend to different parts of their sensory environment. And when we are just talking about decision-making as such, research has shown that decision-making involves a wide variety of brain networks. And that kind of particular composition of such networks will vary from task to task. So, for example, if we have visual tasks, then visually sensitive brain area will be kicking in. And if we have auditory tasks, then auditory cortex of the brain will kick in. Importantly, research has also shown that all these brain areas contribute to so-called integrative brain regions, which then collect all those evidence that sensory brain areas are sending to them in order to make a distinction. So it seems that decision-making is a very effortful process that sort of involves a variety of brain regions, yet are kind of introspective experiences that we kind of make decisions effortlessly. So this is kind of interesting, I find.
Now, neuroeconomics is a bit of a buzzword in academia. How does neuroeconomics explore economic decision-making exactly?
Neuroeconomics is a relatively new or young scientific discipline, and it draws upon knowledge and methods that have been developed in psychology, in cognitive neurosciences, and economics. And in its research, neuroeconomics uses data from typical human populations, atypical or clinical human populations, as well as from animal models. And in terms of how neuroeconomics came to be, people may differ in their opinions, but my take is that neuroeconomics sort of stems from a discipline or subdiscipline of economics called behavioral economics. So you may or may not be aware of how the thought developed in the economic sciences, but in the 70s or 80s of the 20th century, two scientists, Kahneman and Tversky, kind of revolutionized economics by showing that humans tend to make economic decisions or value-based decisions, if you will, in a very biased way. So they have gone and described many sort of cognitive biases that people exhibit when making such decisions, which car should you buy, or when estimating different risk qualities or different values. And this came partly, I think, as a surprise to the mainstream economics, because mainstream economics to that date and potentially economists or specialists in economics will criticize me here, but this is my take. The economic science is kind of the focus predominantly of building theoretical models of how best possible decisions should look like or optimal decisions. And the work of Kahneman and Tversky kind of demonstrated that there's this sort of gap between how choices should look like and how choices actually are in the real world. And that was a bit of a surprise. So their work actually spawned a lot of research. It developed into a whole subdiscipline of behavioral economics. And potentially not surprisingly, that work was awarded a Nobel Prize in economics in 2002. And From the discipline of behavioral economics, cognitive neurosciences kind of came and said, okay, so obviously people are biased in making their decisions. There must be something in the brain that contributes to those biases. And the main focus of neuroeconomics is to characterize the mechanisms that people use in order to make such economical decisions and potentially to identify neural correlates of such biases.
So what exactly is the brain telling us about economics?
That's a good question. Brain as such doesn't really care much for economics, but we can use knowledge that we have collected or models of brain function to potentially constrain theories in economics, because we know that the brain, the way the brain works, has certain regularities, and we can use that knowledge that we have learned from neurosciences in order to sort of inform these economical models. So this is what brain is telling us. Economics as such is a much broader science, so it's not all about individual choices. So broad division in economics is between macroeconomics and microeconomics, and the brain can tell us something about microeconomics, how individuals make choices that involve estimation of uncertainty and risk and involve estimation of value. And we know that there are specific brain networks that contribute to estimating value of something, how much am I willing to pay, and that estimate the risk or the uncertainty of something. And these two things have to come together in order to make one single value-based decision.
I would imagine that, you know, there are obviously people out there who would consider themselves quite conservative when it comes to money and economics. And then there are those people who maybe would consider themselves not to be so wise. What's happening in those different brains? What's the connection there that makes those people do what they do and go through with the decisions?
There are some people who are more risk averse or conservative, that you are, as you are saying, or people who are more prone to taking risk. And obviously, there's a number of factors that influence such differences. There's personality factors. So there's a whole area in psychology that kind of characterize such individual differences. But what brain research can tell us about such individuals is trying to capture brain correlates that contribute to estimating risk, and then kind of using those correlates to order people along their appetite for risk. And in that sense, we can potentially characterize people who make atypical decisions. So we know that, say, chronic gamblers presumably should have much less risk aversion than other people, because they actually actively seek that thrill and that risk because this is kind of rewarding for them. And presumably there should be concomitant brain processes that one can observe in chronic gamblers, which are absent from people who aren't chronic gamblers.
It's so interesting. There's so many elements to it, really. I wonder, are the emotional and the rational decision-making processes the two main things that you look at in your research?
In my personal opinion, I don't think that there's this big divide between emotions and ration, if you wish. I think any decision has some element of emotional responses and some element of rational sort of deliberation. The decisions could be characterized by the degree to which these things are represented, but every single decision, even the most boring one, contains some emotional charge. For example, if you imagine yourself submitting your taxes and kind of claiming certain tax offsets, there is not more boring decision or rational decision than that. But presumably still emotions play a role. For example, I feel deeply frustrated with the whole process. And even when I claim some tax offsets, I'm usually am unpleasantly surprised with what I get in turn. So broadly speaking, I'm not convinced that one can make such a strong sort of distinction between emotionally charged decisions and more rational decision. But you're right. One could think of different types of decisions kind of characterized by a different dimension. So people in psychology as well as in behavioral economics for couple of decades now have been talking about a big division between so-called fast thinking and slow thinking. So fast thinking involves decisions that are sort of are instinctual or gut-related or automatic responses to things. And slow thinking involves decisions that are more deliberate, where we kind of stop and wait to collect a bit more information before responding. And this is an important distinction, because you can imagine that there would be different elements of brain activity that are involved in fast thinking and slow thinking. And research has shown differences there. But also it's interesting to deliberate or to think about all the ways that, say, popular opinion makers are making use of the fast thinking system and leveraging those biases in order to make us do things that we wouldn't necessarily want to do.
It's such a great point. I often think about the, all of the temptations associated with online shopping. You know, it's very convenient. You've either got a device in your hand or, you know, a laptop in front of you and you're just browsing through. I've got friends who, if they've had a really bad week, they will just go and treat themselves by buying a whole lot of whatever it is that they're interested in, whatever makes them happy. What's going on in the brain when we sort of look at, well, going and spending a whole lot of money on a treat after a bad period might be something that, you know, we see as a big reward. What's the decision-making process that goes into that?
Well, there's a whole host of processes, really. So first, we obviously gain some reward from simply buying something, and that reward is signaled by changes in the neurochemistry. So certain neurotransmitters get released that signal pleasure to us, and that sort of works as a reinforcement for future such events, and that essentially train us to behave in a similar way in the future. On the other hand, we exhibit a number of such cognitive biases that motivate us to engage in such, say, impulse bias. So, for example, one of commonly reported biases is fear of missing out. So if we have this sort of anxiety that we will miss on an opportunity to grab a deal, which is, say, some item that's on sale currently, we will be more likely to buy it, even if that sale is not particularly attractive. There's hardwired responses, part of that fast thinking system, that is going to assign greater value to this sort of perceived deal compared to buying the same product when it's not on sale.
It's very interesting in terms of the psychology. Are you able to train yourself out of those sorts of habits, I wonder?
That's a good point. So people also, humans, engage in what we call metacognition. So that's an area or aspect of cognitive system, which is involving thinking about your own thinking. So evaluating your past actions and kind of using that knowledge to inform future behaviors. That's why we call it metacognition. It's a higher form of cognition or thinking about thinking. And we have done some research in that space. And we have used certain neural correlates of decision making as recorded in the brain activity as the brain is busy doing a single task. And we were able to show that even before people make a decision, we can find correlates in the brain activity that inform subsequent metacognitive judgment. So we specialize in changes of mind. We have a whole project with a very talented PhD student who's about to finish, in which we design tasks in where we ask people to make a simple choice, like whether the presented stimulus goes to the left or to the right. So we use such very simplified stimulus material. But importantly, after every such response, we ask them, to which degree would you like to change your mind? So we force them to engage in such metacognitive processes. And we have found that even before people have pressed the button the first time, we can find such measures in the brain activity that can help us predict subsequent changes of mind responses. So that's kind of an interesting thing, because presumably people start to deliberate about their desire to change their mind only after they have pressed the response. But there's something in the brain even before the response happens that they can make use of. And recently we have just finished a study in which we have developed a training protocol. So we had two groups of people and we developed a specific training protocol trying to help people improve on that metacognitive skill. And I just saw these results the other day. Our so-called active or experimental group, where we actually invested in developing a particular training program that should help people make better metacognitive judgments, has an effect on subsequent metacognitive judgments in a specific way, in that it sort of improves people's metacognitive sensitivity, which isn't the case for the other group of people, where we kind of engage them in a task that we didn't expect to improve metacognitive sensitivity. So in that sense, going back to your original question, you can devise training procedure in order to help people improve their thinking about their thinking.
there's quite a lot of scope, I guess, there for programs that can really help people, like problem gamblers, as you suggested earlier as an example. Can you talk to me about game theory? What exactly is it, and how does it provide a convenient platform for neuroeconomic studies?
So broadly speaking, game theory provides an explanation for the ways humans interact with each other. So game theory focuses on specific scenarios in which humans have to interact, and those scenarios are characterized by some certain level of uncertainty. So a very famous example in game theory is a prisoner's dilemma task, in which you can imagine yourself being put in the following scenario. So there's two confederates that are both accused for committing a crime together, and they have been arrested. And now they are kept in isolation, and each of them gets an offer that if they sort of testify against their confederate, they potentially would avoid prison sentence altogether. Now, the game gets more complicated. If both of them testify against each other, they will get, say, 2 years in prison. The final thing is, if one of them testifies and the other doesn't, then the one that didn't testify will get 3 years in prison. So you have this sort of ordering of the punishment that makes different behaviors more or less attractive. And the interesting thing that game theory has shown that in that scenario, independently of how the other person responds, the optimal answer is to testify or to kind of behave selfishly, if you wish. And game theory has developed many, many such scenarios. Prisoner's Dilemma is just the most popular one. And we can use such scenarios to kind of characterize how humans, when put in such scenarios, process that element of uncertainty. So in this sense, game theory provides a good test bed for theories of neuroeconomics. I should say that these two disciplines are independent disciplines in their own right, because neuroeconomics is interested in more, in a broader family of decisions than just such social interactions that game theory is interested in. For example, neuroeconomics is also interested in decisions that have very little sort of social aspect to it. For example, choosing which health insurance policy to invest. That doesn't necessarily involve social interactions, or choosing how to build your investment portfolio. In other words, these two are sort of members of the same family. They can inform each other, but they are not necessarily identical.
And I mean, in traditional economics, you have an opportunity cost, which is sort of sounding a little bit similar, where you've got to weigh up, is this worth it? Is gaining one thing worth sacrificing the other?
Yes, exactly correct. And that particular type of decision requires very demanding cognitive processes in which you need to estimate the risk or the probability with the value of reward. And economics as a scientific discipline has spent a couple of decades trying to capture that mathematically. What neuroeconomics brings to that is trying to see what type of brain mechanisms are responsible for implementing such mathematical algorithms.
Now, tell me, how is it possible for our brains to be manipulated into purchasing one thing over another? And I don't know if it's possible to explain this, but what's going on in terms of the brain activity when a decision like this is happening?
That's a good question. I think experts in advertising and marketing will probably be better able to explain that. My take on that is that such scenarios lend themselves nicely to leverage this fast thinking system. So you can bias the brain or a human cognitive system by sort of engaging more strongly with the fast thinking system than the slow thinking system. And there's a whole theory in economics called nudge economics, developed by a person called Richard Thaler, who also has received a Nobel Prize in economics relatively recently in 2017. Who has described that process. Essentially, we can bias people to, say, buy one product over another by specific organizing the available choices in a specific way. And you may find this whole thing, theory of nudges, you can kind of nudge people to sort of do something that you want them to do and that they don't necessarily would like to do, as something nefarious or malicious. But in my understanding, this is just a tool. So broadly speaking, you can make use of that tool in order to maximize your own profit, or to work in a particular way to maximize welfare of people that you are nudging. So, for example, I believe Queensland government and Australian federal government as well, they all have such nudge teams trying to develop policies in which the easiest behavior or the easiest choice will also be the best possible choice that people can do. So, for example, Richard Taylor has spent a lot of years working on reforming superannuation or retirement system in Scandinavian countries. And he, by implementing such kind of he calls it choice architecture, by presenting people with specific range of choices and by making one of those choices more attractive or the easiest, he has managed to have people save, say, 2 to 3 times more than they would for their retirement. So such nudges can work both ways. My personal interest and scientific interest is trying to characterize what brain mechanisms contribute to the effects of the nudges. And I would leave the implementation to other people, such as an expert in economics or advertising.
But I suppose it's fair to say some people are far more susceptible to the nudge.
Yes, I could imagine. So it's easy to imagine that there's sort of a dimension along which differ, such as susceptibility to nudge. Whether that's a basic dimension, I would rather assume that it's a particular constellation of personality factors or, say, socioeconomic factors, and eventually maybe some sort of brain chemistry or brain functioning.
Now, you've actually recently been given a joint position here at the University of Queensland with the Queensland Brain Institute and UQ's School of Economics, the first of its kind. Can you tell us a bit more about this position and your first research project?
My appointment as a research fellow in neuroeconomics is actually a joint position between QBI and School of Economics. And ideally, that would be just the first step in establishing neuroeconomics as one of the UQ's research strengths. So it's not really present currently at UQ, or for that matter, there is not, to the best of my knowledge, university in Australia that would claim that as their research strength. So in that sense, this is at the forefront of the development of neuroeconomics in Australia. What we are currently working on is trying to establish a broader research network of scientists across Australia that are interested in these value-based decisions. And we are trying to build research project proposals for funding, but we are more interested in actually developing collaborations and investing in future sort of outcomes. Why is that interesting? Why is this topic timely? Well, we live in a time which is characterized by a great deal of disruption, both technological and social disruption. If you just remembered all the upheavals that took place during COVID epidemics and all the different ways that people responded to those threats, what we can contribute here is we can characterize the ways people respond and potentially find protocols such as training protocols or inform policies in order to facilitate better decision making. And that's what we are interested in.
It sounds like it's an area of immense growth. There's so much potential here. So what do you think the big picture for neuroeconomics is going forward?
As I see it, there's two sides to that issue. You are correct, at least I agree with that, that it is a sort of area that stands to experience immense growth. One of the challenges here is that neuroeconomics currently is not necessarily perceived or established in the scientific community as an independent discipline. So one of these challenges would be to promote neuroeconomics, to build a momentum in research that would help identify neuroeconomics as a scientific discipline in its own right. So it's more sort of social or political dimension in that sense. In terms of research, at least the research problem I'm most interested in is coming, is kind of being highlighted in the latest research in neuroeconomics, and that is that people have been able to show that those biases that I was talking about earlier, those cognitive biases that potentially one could sort of ascribe to people being lazy or not really engaging with the task enough, that these biases are not the consequence of people doing the task poorly. Actually, latest research suggests that these biases are sort of emerging consequence of the way the brain is organized and how the cognitive system works. And that's very exciting because by analyzing those biases, we can also characterize the organizational principles of brain function and also organizational principles of the human mind.
Obviously, discovery is at the heart of science. How did you discover that this is an area that you wanted to dedicate your time to and you have such passion for?
The human mind is the most exciting thing in the world. Like using our mind, humanity, or we have managed to learn all sorts of things about the universe. We have managed to develop technologies that help us survive and thrive in our environment. We have built complex social systems. All of that comes from the fact that we have this ability to think and to act in an adaptive and dynamic way. And that was the main reason why I went and studied psychology in the first instance. And thereafter, I realized, well, human mind is sort of constrained by the functioning and organizational principles of the brain. And that's why I went and did a degree in neurosciences. And finally, by starting to work in neuroeconomics, I'm able to make use of my skills coming from psychology and neuroscience to characterize the most interesting aspect of human behavior, for me at least, and that is how humans make tough choices. Because these choices in economics are tough. And this is what I'm most interested in. And being appointed at this position is providing me with the chance to address all those interesting things that I'm fascinated by.
And there would be an assumption that you're very careful about the sorts of economic decisions that you make. But is there ever a time where you do catch yourself just being very, doing the fast thinking and being impulsive when it comes to that type of thing?
All the time. All the time. I do try to, that's a simple trick. I do try to sleep on it. So even if I would really like to buy those shoes that are on sale, I do try to wait at least one night and see how I feel tomorrow.
That's good advice. I think if everybody did that, we'd probably have a lot less credit card debt.
Well, yeah, time will tell.
And just finally, Dragan, what is exciting about this work to you? What are the sorts of things that really light you up in terms of the potential for the future?
There's different things. I think there's a potential to gain new knowledge. That's always exciting. What I also find exciting is the fact that we are at the forefront or at the frontier of human knowledge about something. And being here at QBI or at the UQ in general, that's a dynamic place to be because we are surrounded by ignorance. And by pursuing research in this area, we can kind of decrease that ignorance and make sense of the world around us, make sense of other people, or even help them make better choices. So I think that's quite fascinating.
Dragan, thank you so much for your time today. It's been absolutely fascinating to hear all about neuroeconomics and your journey at the Queensland Brain Institute.
Thank you, Rebecca. It was my pleasure.
If you'd like to learn more or support the work that's done at the Queensland Brain Institute, head to qbi.uq.edu.au. I'm Rebecca Archer, and that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening.